So Dave walked to school with his son Sam every day last week. Dave's wife Morley, who usually takes Sam, is busy in the morning this autumn, which meant she had to miss, for the first time ever, the first giddy days of school. And it would have broken Morley's heart if she could have seen her husband and her son walking along the sidewalk hand in hand. And though she might have felt a pang of jealousy for the lost intimacy of this early morning ritual that has always been hers, if she could have seen them walking along together, she would have thought, I should have done this years ago. Sent them off together like this. Her son's empty backpack, her husband's bulging briefcase. The mornings caught Dave by surprise. On Tuesday, he told Morley walking to the schoolyard with his boy was like walking through a house of mirrors. You bump up against the mirrors of memory in the most unexpected places. You're hurrying your child to school, and you turn a corner and look across the street, and you see a 7-year-old version of yourself standing on the opposite corner. Dave grew up in the town of Middle Contrition, not far from Bedeck in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, Canada, third planet from the sun, the Milky Way, the universe, etc. And this week, kids in Contrition were picked up at their doors and bused to what Dave still thinks of as the new school, only 25 years old and less than 40 miles out of town. When Dave was a boy, he went to school in town. He went to the Upper Contrition Primary Public School on Sleeman Street, which was not only, worse luck, the same school his older sister attended, but the school where his own mother, in one of the greatest treacheries that can be perpetrated on a child, worked as one of the four teachers. And because Dave was Margaret McNeil's son, every year on the first day of school, he would have to endure what every other kid in the Upper Contrition Primary Public School still remembers and cherishes as Miss McNeil's greatest moment. Because every year on the first day of school, the entire student body, all 60 of them, was assembled in the basement lunchroom, and Dave's mother climbed onto one of the 6 picnic tables they kept down there, and to the great amazement of the kids in kindergarten who had never seen this before, and to everyone else's delight, Miss McNeil would burp the alphabet from A to Z. Now, many of the kids in kindergarten actually stopped breathing when they witnessed this extraordinary feat. Their mothers had told them many things about school, but they hadn't told them about this wonderful woman. Some of them were away from their mothers for the first time ever, and they would stand there with their mouths hanging open and think, the world is so immense, and I have so much to learn. It was a performance that damaged live theater for many of them. It was good, they would say many years later, of a play they had just watched. But they would think quietly to themselves, not as good as that morning in September when Miss McNeil burped the alphabet. Even Gretchen Shevastad, who as an adult went on to play in the string section of Symphony Nova Scotia, had more than once stood squinting into the audience after a concert, bowing and thinking to herself how much better the concert would have been if Miss McNeil could have been there. It was true art. Now, if you were in kindergarten at Upper Contrition Public Primary School, you didn't see Miss McNeil again for 5 years until you got to grade 5, and then you had her for 3 years straight, grade 5, grade 6, and grade 7. And for 3 years, you got to take part in the other ritual she is remembered for, the morning challenge. Every morning before anyone was allowed in her classroom, Miss McNeil wrote the morning challenge on the blackboard, and when the bell rang, she expected her students to sit down quietly and work on the quiz. And that's what everybody did, because everyone knew that whoever scored best on the quiz each day would be let out of class 15 minutes early at lunch and got to ride their bike into town and buy Miss McNeil a package of Cools. And they got to spend the 7 cents change on penny candy. And it was a ritual that made the children so happy that even parents who didn't approve of smoking didn't think to question it. We were so free, said Dave to Morley one night last week. Nothing was organized. there was a creek behind the school. We spent hours catching frogs. God, it was fun. On her first day of kindergarten, Morley was made to lie down on a piece of long brown paper while the teacher traced her outline with a thick black pencil. And then Morley was given a box of crayons and told to color in the life-sized outline. Morley started with her eyes, and she made a mistake. Right off the bat, she put the first eye smack in the center of her forehead. Now she knew right away it was the kind of mistake you couldn't come back from. So she asked for another piece of brown paper, and no matter how hard she tried to explain about the eye in the middle of the forehead, her teacher didn't understand. Wouldn't give her another piece of paper, wouldn't let her make a fresh start. Now, instead of turning the paper over and starting again, Morley went back to her spot on the floor and refused to do anything. And at the end of the morning, when everyone's pictures were put up on the wall, Morley's went up too. With no mouth, no hair, and no clothes, just one huge brown eye staring down from the middle of her forehead. And her name written at the bottom of the paper in big black letters. The portrait glared down at her every day for a month. It was humiliating, said Morley, to look at that eye every morning. I felt like it was watching everything I did. That, thought Dave, is the essence of elementary school. You walk around the schoolyard, up and down the corridors, you sit at your desk, and wherever you go, there's someone with one great big eye in the middle of their forehead, staring down at you. We had a fat boy in our class, said Morley. Did I ever tell you about Norman? He got along better with the girls than the boys. But he didn't get picked on, probably because he always had lots of money. He would use it to buy penny candy. The year we were in grade 4, we had Mrs. Merrill, who was strict but nice, and Norman sat in the middle of the class, and sometimes when Mrs. Merrill was writing on the blackboard and her back was towards the class, and the room was quiet because everyone was copying what she was writing on the board into their exercise books, sometimes Norman would reach into his desk and take a handful of penny candy and toss it into the air, and it was like someone had lobbed a grenade into the class. 1 minute dead silence, and the next bedlam. It was too good to be true. And when she remembered Norman and the utter joy of those classroom scrambles that he set in motion when he threw the penny candy in the air, Morley wanted the same thing for Sam. And that's what led her into the schoolyard at 6 a.m. last Monday morning with two rolls of quarters and a roll of dimes and nickels. If she couldn't lob candy around a classroom, she could scatter change around her son's schoolyard. And Morley imagined that a schoolyard full of coins, like pirate's treasure, would create the same joy in her son's memory as Norman's penny candy did in hers. She scattered $27 in loose change around the yard, under the play structure, and in the sandbox, and by the tool shed, and under the stairs where the little kids gathered, and she felt wonderful and light and alive as she did it, even though it was only 6 in the morning. And it didn't matter, she thought, if Sam got any of the money, although she was planning to head home as soon as she had finished and do her best to get him to school early, but it didn't matter. Because schoolyards exist on stories as much as real life. And Sam would be part of the story, and the story would become a legend, and it would grow in the telling, and before long it would be hundreds of dollars. They'd talk about the morning when there were hundreds of dollars in the schoolyard, and kids would be at school early for weeks. And the sure knowledge that would happen again. And it did not, of course, work out like that. After she had finished, Morley went for coffee. On her way home, she detoured by the school to savor the sheer recklessness of what she had done. And there was Floyd, the school janitor, who was never seen within an inch of the schoolyard whenever there was broken glass to be picked up. 6:30 a.m., Floyd plowing around the schoolyard like a Zamboni. sucking up every coin she had dropped. Instead of going home and getting her son up as she had intended, Morley went to a phone booth and called her husband. "Why didn't you stop him?" asked Dave. "Why didn't you tell him it was for the kids?" I was too embarrassed," said Morley. "It was too silly. I'm going to walk to work. The car is parked by the field. Will you pick it up when you take Sam?" And then she hung up. And all morning, Dave imagined with growing regret what might have happened had Floyd not stumbled upon Morley's money. By mid-afternoon, he'd worked himself into such a state that he couldn't concentrate. And at 3 o'clock, he knew what to do about it. He was going to finish what his wife had started. But he wasn't going to fill the schoolyard with spare change for Floyd to scoop. Dave had a better idea. He was going to fill it with frogs. Catching frogs, he said to Morley that night, waving his arms as he walked around the kitchen. It's the essence of childhood. It had only taken Dave 2 phone calls to find the frogs. I called a pet store first, he said, but they only had green tree frogs for like pets. How much, said Morley, is a green tree frog? $9.99 each, said Dave. $15 for two. As she stared at her husband in trepidation, Morley did the math in her mind. 6 frogs, $45. Surely he wouldn't have spent $45 on frogs. There wouldn't be more than 6 frogs. But Dave was somewhere else. Going too fast to notice his wife's growing apprehension, Dave was full steam ahead. Anyway, he said, I had a better idea. Different idea, said Morley. You had a different idea. Bait store, said Dave. Bait store, said Morley. Leopard frog, said Dave. The frogs we caught when we were kids. When you were a kid, said Morley. Then there was a pause that stretched into a silence. Morley and Dave in their kitchen looking at each other, Dave beaming, proud, a little nervous, a lot excited. Morley fearful for what she had created. How much, said Morley, are leopard frogs? They're only $6.99 a dozen, said Dave. And how many are you getting, said Morley. 3 dozen, said Dave. 3 dozen, said Morley. Maybe 4, said Dave. He said it was like a question, like he was asking permission, but he wasn't asking permission because he had already been to the bait store. He had already bought the frogs. They were out in the garage in 5 large plastic boxes, 10 dozen frogs. 120 leopard frogs that Dave intended to set loose in the morning. Morley might have stopped him then, should have stopped him probably, but he hadn't stopped her. She thought she was being supportive. Neither of them imagined Rebecca Lawrence, 5 years old, kindergarten, on the sidewalk in front of the school, clutching her mother's leg, screaming loudly enough that she was heard a full block away. "Take me home," she was crying. Certainly neither of them, Dave nor Morley, imagined Duncan Sheppel, grade 7, would have a Swiss Army knife in his pocket. Or that Mrs. Jenkins, on yard duty that morning, would react with what Dave later described as hysteria when confronted with a frog head. If she hadn't fainted, he said glumly to Morley that night. Things wouldn't have gotten out of hand. Even Dave had to admit things had got out of hand. Children running wildly over the yard. Girls chasing boys. Boys chasing girls. Everyone chasing frogs. Rebecca Lawrence providing the unfortunate soundtrack for the whole sorry scene. What sort of idiot, Dave overheard Rebecca's father say, could have done this? Out of hand, said an icy Nancy Cassidy, the school principal, as Dave sat across her desk the next morning. It was like a prison riot. Nancy Cassidy had always struck Dave as a gentle soul. Now she was speaking to him as if he were a child. "What on earth did you think you were doing?" she demanded, and then, "Perhaps you would consider some form of counseling." Dave had already spent an hour on his knees with Floyd the janitor, scraping frogs off the schoolyard with a putty knife. Surely he thought this was enough. Clearly it was not, and that is why on Monday morning the entire school will be gathered in the lunchroom so Dave can explain what he was thinking when he brought the frogs. Explain why frogs were such a joyful memory, memories he had hoped they would capture as they went about capturing the frogs. And why it was wrong to remove a frog's head. This was his idea, to do this. And he is dreading it. But these are the things you do when you love someone. You try so hard to create good times that they will remember and cherish, and so often the things you try to do go amiss and you spend more time mopping up after yourself than anything else. It always turns out that the things people remember are the things that you'd never imagine. Something you do without even thinking, and when you realize it, you want to say, "I could have done that thing so much better because I love you so much. If I had known that that thing was going to please you, I would have done it more thoughtfully, more mindfully, more often. If I had only known, I would have done it every day of your life. I would pay so much more attention if I could do it again."